I live in the American Gargoyle building on West East 81st Street on the 11th floor. My name is Patruk Baitenswitch. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself and a balanced diet and a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little poofy poof poof, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my tummy crispies. I can do 1,000 now. 1,000 tummy crispies. After I remove the ice pack, I use a deep pore cleanser lotion. In the shower, I use a water-activated cigarette-infused cleanser, then a honey garlic pasta scrub, and on the face, an exfoliating tar and squirrel scrub. Then I apply an herb mint facial mask to my butt cheeks, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use an aftershave lotion with a bunch of alcohol in it, because alcohol makes you drunk, and I like to start the day a bit fucked up. Then moisturizer, then a hyper-aging eye injection, followed by a final moisturizing protective force field sponsored by NASA. There is an idea of a Patruk Baitenswitch, some kind of abstraction. But there is no real me, only an entity. Something illusory, illusory, something luxurious. And though I can hide my corn maze, and you can shake my hand and feel my jammed fingers from basketball practice, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there. Because I'm right here.
Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight? Bad science.
Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Bad Science. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and I am beyond delighted today to be talking about one of my favorite movies, American Psycho 2000's Christian Bale, Mary Harron's American Psycho. I have two unbelievable guests today. Usually, I'm not going to lie to you, a little peek behind the curtain here. I'm a little bit nervous. Maybe I don't know the guests or I'm intimidated, but I've spent time with both of you before and I know that today's going to be fantastic. No pressure. Our first guest is Caltech's Assistant Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience who specializes in fear, Dr. Dean Mobbs.
Thank you.
How's it going, Dean?
Great. Yeah,
Haven't seen you in a few months now.
I think, yeah, it was Halloween, I think, last time.
Oh, wow,
just
you're right.
Halloween,
yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's not quick.
And of course, pretty much my comedy dad over here, which I'm a little offended that you haven't adopted me officially as your son.
But the paperwork's
we'll,
in.
We'll get into it. Maybe you can diagnose my psychosis. It's 5-time Emmy-winning comedy writer Tom Martin.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I also specialize in fear.
What are you afraid of, Tom?
I don't know. That's the problem.
No, I'm so delighted. I've wanted you on the program for a long time, Tom. I know I've told you that before.
But you found out American Psycho. Tom.
Yeah. Who could I get? Who's the
Tom when
guest?
I fear?
So give me your take on the movie. I've always loved this movie since I was young. What if anybody can go first?
Well, yeah. I'd say it's just a reminder of how great the 80s were.
Sure.
I just miss those days when you could just be a raging psychopath and get away with it.
No one cares.
The other thing I noticed is this movie got right is how everyone talked a little bit and had the swagger of Dennis Miller. Lot of like head bobbing, cha-cha, yeah. Let me tell you, you got less money in your 401k than the blah, blah, blah.
Right.
There was that attitude. Anyway, one thing that stood out.
No, sure. I mean, I'm delighted you're both here because I was born in 88, so I did not get to experience the 80s.
Right.
And we were talking a little bit briefly before this about how this was it really captured what the 80s were like.
It really did.
So did you feel like that also?
Yeah, I think it definitely did. There was, the Wall Street movie. It's sort of even a parody of that. It's the extension of this psychopathic personality. And in the 80s, the Ferrari drive, it's all about image, the slick back hair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, this is totally fits with, my perception of coming from England of what a lot of Americans, particularly in New York, were like.
Yeah. Right. And did you enjoy the film? Did you find
it
fun?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. And I think it gives a really good portrayal of what a kind of CEO type psychopath is, and a young, ambitious psychopath.
Yeah.
And I think it really captures that. And And you know, for me, it's like the character is a molding together of Ted Bundy and Donald Trump Jr.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, totally.
Good call.
And I think Christian Bale does an absolutely fantastic job in it.
Oh my God. Christian Bale is so good in this movie.
One thing I thought they did really well is distinguish between a murderous psychopath and just your run-of-the-mill sociopath. You know, like a lot of these guys are full-on sociopaths, or at least have become conditioned to act like one, but there were a few instances where Bateman, the main character, went too far, and even the sociopaths went, "Hey, easy, head on a stick."
Whoa, dude!
You know, so I think that was really interesting, because a sociopath may not quite be a murderous psychopath. They may not have empathy, or they may even be selfish as shit,
right?
But they're not going to put anyone in their refrigerator.
Yeah. That was one of the main things I wanted to talk about today is the difference between all of these terms, because I started to research, and they're like certain things I recognize: narcissistic personality disorder. There was another. I have too many notes today. Usually, I feel like I don't have enough notes, and I'm like panic. Yeah. There won't be enough, and today there's just so much I wanted to ask you about. But narcissistic personality disorder, malignant narcissism, borderline personality disorder, a psychopath, a sociopath. So could you maybe clarify some of that for us?
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly a psychopath, and the psychopath is typically diagnosed with a psychopathy checklist developed by Barbier up in Canada. And this is a 20-item scale in some respects. And he characterizes many of those components. I'll get to the difference with a sociopath in a minute, but what he really characterizes is this glibness, this self-righteousness, this immoral behavior, this lack of empathy. That, I think, really is what you see sort of like in a psychopath. A sociopath is a term that's used interchangeably with a psychopath, but really more to do with when an individual is somewhat like Patrick Bateman. Like you were saying, the difference between the sociopath of his friends and then is the psychopath. And I think that's a really good characteristic of what the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath. That, you know, a psychopath is the one that you do anything. If you block them, they'll do anything to stop you in some respects. They'll kill you, you know?
Right.
And the sociopath is your classic CEO, is the more of the sort of the controlled guy who treats people very, very badly. I'm not going to say that there's a guy who's in the president's office at the moment who does this,
right.
But it's actually a pretty good example of what a sociopath is. It's somebody who's got charm. They can manipulate people, and they have different morals from the rest of us. You know, they can treat everyone the way that they want to treat them, but if you treat them that way, the same way, they'll kill you.
Right.
Or they'll do everything they can to impede you in some way.
Right.
So that's the difference. And then narcissistic personalities, these are all interchangeably in some respects. You're going to see some aspects of narcissistic personality in the psychopath.
Bit of a Venn diagram going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. And narcissistic personality, again, is somebody who's just, you know, everything evolves around them. And, you know, I guess, like I say, it's sort of interconnected with the psychopath and sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
Do each of these characteristics or disease, I don't know if you call them disease, disorders, how much do each of them know what they have and how much do they struggle with it? Because it seemed like the fact that we could identify with this character for an hour and a half proves he is human enough like us, because he's struggling. And there were times where he seemed to be wanting to connect with people or wanting to access regular human emotions, but couldn't.
It's a good question. The science behind it, you know, it shows that, well, by Adrian Ray and others, it shows that when you give somebody a psychopath, an electric shock, or a startle response, a loud startle noise, this in everyone else, most normal people, will cause a skin conductance response, an autonomic nervous system response. It's flat in them.
Wow,
so you think about this, that, and then people have prefrontal damage from a very young age as well, which is the sort of more rational part of our brain, the brain that really picks upon the social components of our environment that are important, things like guilt as well and things like that. You see with them, with these as well, is they've really failed to learn the rules. You know, if you think about it, when you were a kid, your parents told you off when you did something wrong. That's not a very nice way to speak to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be upset at that, you know. You imagine if you didn't feel upset at that. And actually, you may even get some joy out of it.
Right.
Wow. And you're developing like that. Yeah. You know, so it's a developmental disorder, clearly. And there's clearly some genes as well that are associated with that.
Lisa. Right. Because yeah. they specifically chose not to go into his backstory in his childhood very much or at all in the movie. I don't know if they did in the book, but I did wonder, how did he get this way? How much is nature? How much is nurture?
Right.
And
I mean, there's clearly a genetic, you know, nature component to it. And usually, you know, there's some people out there, there's just a simple algorithm of how you create these people. And it's basically you have the template there with the specific set of genes that people have, these dopaminergic genes and serotonergic genes. And in the, I won't go into the details about that, but that we have different expressions of genes as associated with our different, which are associated with our expression of neurotransmitters in our brain. So, for example, like the psychopath really needs to push the boundaries to get any thrill out of anything. So that's why they do these sometimes do these crazy behaviors, or they kill someone because it's the only way they can feel like us. Right. You know, what makes us happy when we see a cute picture of a puppy,
right,
or our loved one,
yeah,
activates these dopaminergic systems, these reward systems in our brain. To them, it's nothing. You know, it doesn't mean anything. They're not getting them same reward signals in their brain. As we do. So
that's so sad.
It kind of is, but you know, they do have insights into what they do. They do know right from wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't care.
Wow,
that's the key thing.
Yeah, because if you notice in the movie, he would get giddy when he was about to kill someone. He almost became like a Jim Carrey character.
Yes.
He was over animated and excited, and
yeah, that
kind
famous,
of his body was wiggling. Yeah,
the famous scene. Well, he always plays this pop music, which really, you know, gets him into this great mood. And then there's that famous scene with Paul Allen where he's like essentially dancing. He's really getting into the groove. He almost like moonwalks at one point, and he's really getting off on that.
And what was it, Huey Lewis in the News?
Huey Lewis in the News.
Okay, here's my. Can I tell you my theory?
Please.
Here's my freshman college analysis.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I really have to mention here, Tom did 9 pages of notes. Tom has so many notes, so much more than anyone else, so much more than me. I usually have like 3 to 4 pages of notes, and Tom sent me at 12:30 a.m. last night.
In case I need to read them.
I get this email from Tom of like, I hope this is okay if you could print out these notes. So many. So I know that this podcast could go 5 hours easy.
But Tom, I'm just pulling mine out of my butt.
You're good.
That's because you're smart. I need crutches.
No, same. I'm a schmuck. I have to read off these things I found on the internet, which most of the time are wrong. But anyways, you have a theory. I want to hear this theory.
So I thought it was interesting that the way he discussed music from an analytical point of view, he analyzed music. He wasn't listening to music.
Right.
In the same way that he couldn't feel empathy or feel the human condition in the same way. The human experience is meant to be experienced and lived. And music is meant to be listened to and enjoyed. But he didn't listen to and enjoy music. He analyzed it. He was searching for some, and he wasn't wrong about the analysis of it. But like Kanye West isn't good at analyzing music, but he's pretty good at making music. So analyzing music and making and understanding music aren't necessarily the same thing. What do you think, music guy?
Yeah, well, I was going to relate it back to when he was in the restaurant, another scene that we spoke about, where he's talking about, he gives this like very presidential sounding speech about what he, I can't remember the other guy's name now, but he says something about Sri Lanka, where he's like, well, we have bigger problems in Sri Lanka. And then Bateman goes on this whole tirade of like, these are the things that are important, and it's stopping terrorism, and it's feeding the homeless.
Right.
And it's what, and it sounds like, well, yeah, these are all, you're right. Like, these are all good humanistic points of view, you know, philanthropic sounding things. But there's also a side of it where it's like, do you actually believe any of this? Are you feeling any of this? And you get that feeling with the music too, where he's talking about Phil Collins and Whitney Houston, and he's delivering it in a way where you're like, yeah, this is all spot on analysis of music, but how much is he really enjoying
the
you know, he listens to a Robert Palmer.
He's Simply listening, Irresistible in the limo irresistible. On the way to
and
Reese Witherspoon.
He's not like, he, there's a voiceover where he says, I think, I was trying to enjoy the new Robert Palmer album.
Right.
You know, but he's not doing, he's just sitting there like staring out of a window, taking it in, almost like you're saying, hey, very analytical.
Right.
But not just rocking out. Like, I'll put on Blink 182 and I'm not thinking about anything technical. I'm just rocking out. I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very good point. I think the way you can think about this, that this could be an alien.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an alien that's trying to understand human nature.
Yes.
And it's using music as a way of trying to understand what is it, what's this feeling that they, what is this emotion, what is it, you know?
Yeah.
And music is the way that we listen to it. It evokes emotionless. We listen to other people's emotions in music. So you can think about it as an alien. It's really interesting from a psychological empathic perspective, because they do separate empathy into two components, which is the cognitive empathy and the emotional empathy. And it's very clear that the emotional empathy is psychopaths do not have it.
Mm.
But, you know, the research has been shown they do have a cognitive empathy. They understand other people. They understand other people's states. They just don't get the feeling states that we get. And that's probably also why they're pretty good at manipulating us, because they can use that as more of a logical way of, like, I know what you're thinking. I don't, you know, or how, I don't feel what you're feeling when I see you in pain, but I can logically take this apart and understand that it's something negative, you know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like you could think they could have actually wrote this as he's an alien that comes from another planet and just has to drink the blood of other human beings. And you know,
right? You're right. Yeah, right. It wouldn't have changed that much about what's going on.
Well, it was a little like your discussions of some of the AI movies where these AI humanoid things are trying to understand human emotion, but they really can't quite get it.
Yeah.
And he is like an alien in that way. And the scary thing is that he is a percentage of the human population.
Luckily, what percentage of the human population?
Psychopaths.
Sure.
I think it's something like 1% or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Like,
that's reassuring. That's nice. I looked up some, it says serial killers, 5 out of 6 are male. They come from tough upbringings.
Yeah.
Most are not brilliant. They're like underachievers.
Yeah, you have the unsuccessful psychopaths and the successful ones. There's this work on this as well.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. And then, but then I read it said 1 in 150 people are psychopaths.
Yeah.
And that most of them are criminals.
So you have to consider what the definition is of a psychopath.
Okay.
Usually with the psychopathy scale, if you score above 30 out of 40 in it on this classic scale that, as I mentioned earlier, Barbera created, then you're defined as a psychopath. But there's varying different degrees of being a psychopath. For example, Ted Bundy scored 39 out of 40.
Wow. Okay. What's the name of that scale one more time?
Just the psychopathy.
The guy's name?
Inventory. Yeah. Bob Eyre.
Yeah, okay.
He's at University of British Columbia. He might be retired now.
Okay.
But
how do you take this test, or do you analyze?
You have to be trained on it for I actually took the course on it up in San Francisco about 15 years ago now.
And what'd you score? No,
I didn't 29, take it. He's fine.
I'm 29. Well, that's the key thing, you see. That's what I'm trying to get back to. If you're 29, mm-hmm. 28, 29, mm-hmm. you're not clearly defined as a psychopath yet, but you're pretty much up there.
Okay.
Keep an eye on him.
And this comes back to the question about the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath, because one of the key things of a psychopath is parasitic behavior. Mm. You'll use other people to get something from them, particularly financial.
Right.
And that's where it's a lot of the less smarter ones will be, really. The really smart ones will be the president of the United States of America.
Right, right, right.
But
the less smart ones just live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and they'll but they'll find victims. They'll find people who they can manipulate. And most of us just say, yeah, you're full of crap, you know, I'm not going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
We all know those types of people. But these are the sorts of people, you know, like Charles Manson. I mean, would you listen to that guy, this scraggly little guy, you know, he's like 5'2" or whatever.
Right.
But he got these people who are educated to do bad things, you know.
Yeah.
And that's another example of being manipulating people and so on. So, you know, there's how we clinically define psychopathy is there's a clear sort of cutoff, but you know, I think there's a sort of boundary
sliding
there.
Scale. Yeah. Here.
If you're scoring closer to 30, maybe 20, 25, you're still not probably a very good person to be around. You know,
got it. Yeah. But you can't just take someone to like a CVS and do this test.
So you have to take a course. And then the course is basically you have to train for so many hours on this course to answer in ways that you ask the question, you answer the way you ask the questions, the information you get about those individuals as well determines the score as well. If you're not trained properly, you could miss, you know, well, you know, that person's a psychopath because they think they score high on this. But when
But I'm saying the person doesn't need to be trained that you're scoring.
No, the teacher.
The teacher.
The teacher.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, you're trained.
So I could bring you people, and then you can analyze where they are.
Are the trick questions like, where do you put your sever head? A, in the freezer. A, in the refrigerator. B, in the backyard. Well, B, because it could be a trick question. The question is to see if they go, what the fuck? The correct answer is, who has a severed head? But if they answer B, you put the severed head in the freezer so it doesn't
stink. You don't have to ask them any other questions. Okay, so I want to, before we get into Tom's encyclopedia of notes and my own notes, because I know we can talk about all this forever, I do want to distract us for a second and go on a tangent of just fun, because I have a game here.
What's more fun than psychopathy?
Honestly, it's so fun, and I this morning was thinking, we don't need a game. I don't have to do a game. It's just going to take away from information, but whatever. I did make a game, so we might as well do it, and it's called...
I don't have to kill someone, do I?
Bring in the intern. No, you don't have to kill anyone. It's called, Do You Like 80s Pop? And essentially, I'm going to play you bits of a few songs from the 80s, and I want you guys, as quickly as possible...
How old are you, Professor?
47.
Okay, I'm 54. This is my wheelhouse.
Okay. I was hoping it was both of your wheelhouses, but anyways, I'll play you a bit of a tune. Whoever chimes in first gets that point, okay? As soon as you think you know it, I want the artist and the song title.
It's not going to be some obscure American pop, though, isn't it?
It's not obscure, but it is American pop.
Well, we got that.
Well,
we got
actually,
that.
Some of it...
No, some, it's
some British,
some
British
of it,
in there.
Some, yeah, yeah. Some of it... I don't want to give too much away. So I'm gonna step away. I'm going to play... Basically, we're like in my bedroom apartment, and I'm just going to like play you stuff from the computer here, and you guys chime in, okay?
Okay.
Tell me what's up.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the first one.
Phil Collins. I mostly listen to cool music in the 80s.
This is the worst song I ever heard.
See, my girlfriend would know this, but I was listening to rock and roll. I know the song. I don't know. But is it Whitney Houston?
It is.
Oh, it is.
Oh, he did. This is from that album he referenced, isn't it? Like four hits on this album. I never.
You've got your nose cheating.
Answer was, "You give good love." Okay. Whitney Houston. See,
I have never heard that song before.
See, and if I heard 5 seconds of it while driving, I would have pressed to the next radio station.
No comment on the...
I'm sure I could handle it now, but there are other social forces at work when you're 15 and what music
If my wife was playing that, I would say, turn this crap off now.
All right, here's this one.
Oh, gosh, you'll know this.
This is... I love this song, loved it since I was little. It gets me very hyped up. That's all I'm going to say.
Phil Collins.
Genesis. Turn it on.
Yes. Oh, you got me.
All right.
So this is Genesis with Phil Collins?
This is Off Duke. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Turn It On Again from 1980s Duke, Genesis. Love that tune. If you don't know that tune, please go check it out.
I listened to
that
the other week, actually. I'm surprised it took me so long.
Right, I know.
It's the pressure. It's the pressure.
Well, also, I think it's the speakers from a computer. Like, if we had cool speakers from high school.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. I'd know that Whitney Houston song then.
Huey Lewis in the News. I want a new drug. Who got a perfect score on the math SAT, by the way.
Really?
She Drives Me Crazy by...
No.
How will I know Whitney Houston?
Yeah. Wow, it did sound a little bit like She Drives Me...
Yeah, it did, actually. I was confused.
Last one.
This is Genesis. Leave my number.
Pat Benatar? Wait, who is it?
This is Phil Collins.
Oh, okay, right.
Phil Collins, sorry.
It sounded a little bit like...
That was Phil Collins, Don't Lose My Number.
He's skewed way too British.
I did ask for some British in there. You did give me some.
I gave you some British.
If you played Rush songs, I would have got them all.
Yeah.
Next time.
I wanted to pay a little homage to the film there. Also, I didn't realize I was watching some of those music videos, and they are hilarious. If you guys get a chance, watch those. Whitney Houston, that How Will I Know music video is so funny.
You're talking to two guys who grew up in the 80s. We were there.
So funny. But looking back on it now, I think it's so much funnier, because back then it's probably like, oh, this is like new and hip and kind of cool. But now it just looks so dated.
Yeah.
And the Phil Collins ones, for some reason, he, like, there's at least 30 seconds to a minute of almost every music video of his where there's like a, it's like a movie. There's like a scene. He's talking to people. They're making jokes. Hilarious. Highly recommend everybody go check that out. Okay. The huge question that people have about this movie afterwards was if it was in his head or not.
Right.
Did he actually kill people? So I want to put it out to you guys, and then I'll give you my theory, my take on it.
Right. Yes. I think my feelings is that he did, but wasn't, he lost a little bit of track or a grip on reality at the end for who knows why. So maybe some of them he wasn't sure about. And then the other thing that keeps me from being able to answer correctly is the mistaken identity element of it.
Right,
did he kill Paul Allen? Or did he kill someone pretending to be Paul Allen? Did he go out to dinner with a guy who was pretending to be Paul Allen while he was pretending to be someone else and kill that guy while Paul Allen was in England?
Yeah, that was also, and I just want to quickly mention how the movie was also so funny. I've always found it really funny and genre bending, right? It's not just one. It's like a suspense, horror, comedy, thriller.
Right.
Like, what the hell is going on in this movie? There was, like, the mistaken identity stuff is so funny and so on the nose. And then he has those lines about returning videotapes.
Right.
But, like, there's just really obvious comedic moments in this film where if you, somebody could die in a horrific way at any moment, but it's still, like, all that stuff was so funny. Anytime they're like, that's impossible. I just had dinner with him in London. Right. Like, and they all look the same. I don't know.
I thought
that was very good. But anyways, did he kill anyone? Dean Mobbs.
I think it's difficult to say. I mean, it's clearly sold from the statement that he is. But what we do know is that a lot of psychopaths also have all these fantasies about killing people. And often a lot of the psychopaths will... Emily Lee Lucas, for example, said he killed 100, 200 people, whatever. It was a very large amount, but he only got traced back to about 5 or 6 or something small like that.
Rookie.
But he was clearly lying about it and had a fantasy about doing it and that. So it's sort of interesting, that is this part of his fantasy or is it real? Or is it a bit of a mixture of both?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's an interesting
question.
Well,
he became a different kind of crazy person at the end when we hadn't seen any evidence of this to the point where the ATM machine asked him to feed a cat into the machine. That seemed like a different kind of, I don't remember this, towards the end, he's kind of losing it. He's getting cash out of the ATM and he sees a cat and then the video or the ATM says, put cat.
Yeah, feed me a stray cat.
Yes.
Yes.
And that was, he didn't seem to be that delusional.
He was that all of a sudden, towards the end there, he's having like hallucinations and just weird. He like shoots the cop car and it explodes. Like, and he looks at the gun also like, what the hell is going on? I don't even know what's happening anymore. Okay, so Brett Easton Ellis says that it's not about murder. I think his whole point is that like it doesn't actually matter if he killed anyone or not. Like he always had a problem with the film being a film in general, because in film there's answers, like you see him kill people, so that is like a definite, oh, he's killing people. But in the novel it's a lot more what's the word I'm looking for, you know,
in depth, they go
ambiguous.
Okay,
it's a lot like you're not sure what is actually happening, and that's kind of the point, is that it's a statement on, you know, yuppie culture and identity melding and you know, trying to stand out while everybody's homogenized. So I thought that was kind of cool, and I did get that feeling there towards the end that it almost didn't matter. Like I think one of the last things he says is that this means nothing. Like my confession means nothing. And so to me also, that was like a little hint of like, oh, I'm here sitting here trying to figure out who he killed and what happened to the bodies in Paul Allen's apartment. I'm trying to like solve the case, but in actuality, the whole movie's clearly not about a murderer. It's just about this whole, all these men that are like super power hungry and all about themselves and superficial, that the killing doesn't even matter. It's not about that. You know, it's just about them and how fucked
up they
are.
Or the superficial exterior. I thought they really put a nice button on the end by showing Ronald Reagan, who's like everyone's grandfather and seems like a lovable guy.
Yeah.
But he is the ultimate example representing a lot of politicians who can put that face on a crime that results in deaths of millions of innocent people,
right,
or whatever it is. And that's what those guys are. They have a slick exterior and that hides interior full of mayhem and destruction.
Yes.
And I think Mitt Romney is a perfect example of that. Ooh. Mitt Romney is every bit the psychopath that Donald Trump is. If you look into Bain Capital and Vulture Capitalism, like his whole company is designed to go in and take over companies, buy them out and loot all the assets, fire everybody, and steal the pensions.
Whoa.
I mean, that's what he does. That's what Bain Capital does.
Damn.
And that's what they do, is these people do such terrible shit that the normal person can't even comprehend it.
Right.
They're just like, you know, we think about an axe to the head, but there's more destruction in what Bain Capital does to a company by throwing everybody out of their future earnings that Whoa. They worked hard for,
yeah,
and giving it all to stockholders.
My friend was saying about, he worked on Wall Street, and this one guy came in, and he basically, his job was just to fire everyone. Yeah,
nice. rough job.
And at the end of the day, he'd fired all these people in his company, and he said he just saw him walking down the hallway whistling to himself.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Like, it didn't matter, you know.
No.
And the truth is that, you know, the psychopath is valuable in some sense. These are the people who a lot of the time will do the things that other people won't do, particularly within the social realm. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that our morality stops us from doing things. They don't care about that. They'll do them. They have a function in society in some
right.
respect.
They're here. They're here.
They've evolved. They continue to evolve.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And they're here for a reason, because there must be some selection pressure on that type of personality. But like you say, I mean, some people can you know, do something terrible like Mitt Romney, but then come across as a really
yes.
nice guy. You know, it's like,
friendly,
he's a good
man.
Republican. You know?
I feel like usually that's how it is, right?
Right.
I mean, they don't. I think it's more often than not that they're this charming, you know, fun-loving, good, you know, I'm here to have a good time
and
hang out.
That's what's interesting about Donald Trump. If you compare side by side Mitt Romney with Donald Trump, is people seem okay with Mitt Romney because he speaks a certain way and he's smooth.
Yeah.
But the difference is as far as how they feel about operating a business, and really, and it's always good to remember the people in Wall Street don't care about you. For example, they busted some emails in Goldman Sachs where they refer to their best customers as Muppets. In other words, they're there to take advantage. They're there to take advantage of customers.
Right, right.
And the attitude in Wall Street is, if you're so stupid that we can rip you off, then you deserve to be parted from your money. And that's something you always have to remember with Wall Street, no matter how much they say otherwise. They're there to make money off the skim, and the more that they can razzle dazzle and confuse you, the more they can skim.
Damn.
I think that the Patrick Bateman character really, you know, characterizes that type of individual that does exist in the 80s and still today.
Totally.
I think it's a real good characterization of them. I mean, in some respects, it's probably a caricature of them. You know, not many people are like that in the real world, but. Apart from the Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah. Apart from the people running the government.
Yeah, running the government. Yeah. But Donald Trump Jr. to me is Patrick Bateman. I mean, some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just like, this guy has no idea about real people, because since he was born, you know, he's been having Michelin star meals for you know, delivered to him or whatever when he was in diapers, you know.
Yeah.
He has no idea what it's like, what real people are like.
Can,
you know?
Can I tell a quick story about, and this may not be true, I'm not telling you who told me it, but a friend of mine went to University of Pennsylvania with Donald Trump Jr.
Ooh.
And one time, Donald Trump came by to pick up Donald Trump Jr. to go to a baseball game or whatever. And Donald Trump Jr. was just wearing regular college boy clothes. And Donald Trump supposedly, take this for what it's worth, mm-hmm. it's removed three or four people from what actually happened at the time. Donald Trump slapped Donald Trump Jr. in the face and said, put on a suit.
Whoa.
So, you know, like, who knows what... That's a fucked up family.
Yeah. I mean, that's for sure.
I wouldn't go to the game. I'd say, Dad, I'm not going to the game with you.
I'm not going to the game. I have to wear a suit, Dad. You jerk. Also,
so,
stop beating me,
please. I have a question about fear. And you mentioned Professor Mobbs, that the psychopath can't – you do that – you test the autonomic nervous system and they're flatlined if you do a loud noise. Is that – also true with any fear? Do these guys not have fear?
Yeah.
So
they show a reduction in the fear. There's a bit of a paradox there in some respects, because their personality is very self-protective. It's all about me, and I'm the one who would, you know, if a truck was coming, I would push you in front of it to save myself, you know. So that element of they clearly have some kind of idea about what is dangerous and what's not dangerous. It's just they don't have the bodily feelings of it.
Right.
And the real clear thing about it is, you know, they can show certain elements of empathy. For example, they can really care about the dogs, for example. You know, if their dog gets hurt, they're like, oh no, that's really bad. But then they can go and kill someone, you know.
Right.
So they're able to separate these cognitive and emotional components. Whether they feel the emotion is one thing, but they can certainly express it in a way that makes you feel that they're feeling it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So back to that question of fear. No, they don't show the same fear responses in the brain. They see a reduction in the fear circuits in the brain, regions such as the amygdala is sort of decreased in them. They show reasonably normal prefrontal cortex activity, though, depend upon the task. But generally, they do have pretty good rational insight into other people's behaviors and so on. So they're using more of this cognitive, maybe the cognitive strategizing system, but the emotion that we feel is missing in some respects. Yeah.
Wow.
So I have some questions about that kind of stuff, hippocampus stuff, amygdala stuff, neuroplasticity. And before we get there, I have really stupid questions that I wrote down while watching the movie that I wanted you guys to weigh in on that probably don't have any basis in science. I just wanted your take because I wrote them down. So he describes at the beginning his facial scrub procedure. He has like all different types. He says alcohol dries his face out. He uses an anti-aging balm. I don't really know about this stuff. Okay. I clean my face. I have a cleanser. So I just wanted to ask you guys, if you do anything, if you've come across stuff that works for you, how do you clean your face? That's my question.
Well, I'm dry in general. So I don't use any soap on my face ever. Where my wife is, she can get acne. I never had acne. So she used a lot of products. And I hardly ever wash my face other than in the shower with a little soap.
So, a little soap in the shower.
Yeah, no
products. For Tom Martin.
No products.
Moisturizer because you're dry? No.
I mean, if it's super dry, I might, but.
Okay.
Nah.
Normally, you're a natural man.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I get up in the morning, I'll take the cucumbers off my eyes. And then I have a face patch. And no, I'm the same. Actually, I just realized I've never washed my face. I just stuck it under the shower.
Either, yeah.
I get whatever falls off my head from the surf, you know.
It's
my cleanser, yeah, but I've never washed my face.
Did you have acne when you were younger?
No.
Man, no. I mean, maybe you guys were just lucky or something. Yeah. I had acne when I was younger, and I feel like my face is just full of shit. So I try to clean my face.
As a grease ball?
I wouldn't say I'm a grease ball human being, but I wouldn't say, no, I don't know. I think I just need to, I don't know, up my game. And I thought, oh, maybe I can take some advice from this movie. Seems to know what he's talking about over here. So I wanted your guys to take, both of you, super smart.
So what do you use on your face?
I have like a friggin' Trader Joe's all-in-one cleanser, which I use. And then at night, sometimes I'll put some moisturizer, like a lotion type thing, facial lotion. I don't know, because I heard you're supposed to do that. And anyways, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Lithium, he recommends that this girl uses lithium, and so I wanted to ask you, like, why would people use that? Do people still use it today?
I got this one, Professor.
Oh, please.
You take it.
I'm not, no idea.
I have no idea either.
Oh, okay. Sweet, so we're all confused.
I'm just thinking about, like, sticking a battery on your face or something, you know. Like,
yeah,
you know.
He said it very nonchalant, and I thought, oh, maybe that was just a thing that has changed now from the 80s to now.
But is that a pharmaceutical thing, or is it a facial cream.
No, no, it's like pharmaceutical. He was telling this girl who was like drugged out and like completely out of it.
Oh, the one he's
like,
having an affair with.
An affair with, yeah. He told her in the car, like, why don't you have some lithium and some caffeine, and you'll really feel better. Right, and I was like, what? Why do people take that? Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, stupid question. Speaking of which. Business cards. There's a few scenes that are really into, and I used to have business cards when I was just trying to like get gigs and stuff. I would pass out business cards with my email on it and stuff like that. So I wanted to ask you guys if you had business cards. Do you still have business cards? Do you use that kind of stuff?
No, in my business, it just seems like you're only two people removed from the person that might eventually hire you anyway. So all they have to do is call is, hey, how much of an asshole is Tom? Is he easy to work with? He's fine. All right, fine. So you're not going to really like, no one needs it.
Yeah.
Everybody knows you eventually. But I think I have other thoughts on that business card thing, which was fascinating, and how it showed how this crazy bastard in that culture makes a big deal out of little things, but didn't care so much about big things. It's the little details that sets them off.
Right, the spoon on the table.
Right,
you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. I've never had any business cards. We have the option to have them, you know, at work, but most people, you know, kind of, they look you, we have Google Scholar now, so there's things like that where people can look you up and look at, you know, all that information about you. But you know, I don't know about you guys, but whenever someone gives me a business card, it's almost like it gets stuck in my back pocket, right. And then, you know, the next time you find it is when you wash your jeans about a year later.
Yeah. It always takes me back a second when somebody hands me their business card. I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? Who am I?
Right. Yeah, yeah. What industry? I feel like there are certain, like real estate is probably a real estate agent needs one, or
yeah. Maybe business cards. Yeah.
These finance guys, maybe if they feel like they need it to drum up business, I don't know.
I just didn't know if it was also like still a thing. Yeah, maybe it was cool then because you needed it, because everybody had like those Rolodex and, you know, address books, and that it was all like this tactile shit. Right. But I feel like now, I don't know. I've been handed a business card a few times, and it's always strange to me.
It's always strange to me. I always think like, why the fuck are you giving me this? You
know, yeah,
like, giving me something. I don't want it. Don't take it away.
Yeah. Know? Is there something to what Tom was saying about this like OCD type behavior with sociopaths or narcissistic personality or psychopaths where like they
cared
obsess
about
over
coasters on tables and things getting messed up?
Yeah,
and
there's definitely like that component within this character. I wouldn't say that's a common feature of psychopaths, but certainly what's important to him is about what he thinks other people think about him.
Right.
And that's it's the little things that he thinks that, and maybe within that culture you're seeing it, they're all comparing each other's business cards.
Yeah.
And it's these small things, but you know, one of them comes out on top. It's all competition, you know. So when you add that competition element to it, you know, we you know, talking about that, I mean, what's an interesting study we did a few years ago with some colleagues in Japan, is that what you find is that when people envy people more, you get this so you have somebody and you discover that, you know, maybe you've got the latest Tesla, what I really want, and I envy you for that, yeah? And then I find out something bad happens to you. You know, you smash it up and, you know, you go in hospital. What happens is that the more that I envy you, the more schadenfreude I get. So that's the enjoyment at something bad happening to you.
Whoa, right.
So it comes back to this whole element that there's this, and what drives that is competition. That, you know, and this is clearly a very competitive culture that these guys are in.
Yeah.
And it's the little things that matter. Just one, you know, the gold might shine a little bit different on the lettering of the card.
Right.
This would just be one tick. Okay, I beat you. Right. I beat you. So, you know, within that culture, I imagine that's more important.
Are there ways to combat that? Because I feel like that happens on a micro scale all the time,
every business, especially ours.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and it feels to me like a little nuts. Like, I'm a competitive guy. If we're on the basketball court, my friends will tell you I really want to win. You know, I'm not going to yell at anybody, I'm not going to like pout, but when we're in the game, I'll do whatever I can to try and win this game. But when it comes to these like life things, like, I'm not going to, you know, envy somebody for, you know, what they have, and I'm not going to get really jazzed up when things go wrong. You know, it's just not part of my personality. Yeah. But I do think it happens to a lot of people. And is there a way that we can actively you know, recognize it and try to minimalize it.
Well, within the field, economics and social psychology is the social comparison sort of problem and equity aversion. You find out, I'm happy in my job and I'm earning a certain salary and I've been working here for a while. And then you find out that your colleague is doing exactly the same job, same position, mm-hmm. is earning more money than mm-hmm. you. All of a sudden, the amount of money you have is, wait a minute, right. I want more, you know.
Yeah.
So how do you get over that? Well, you know, you reduce the inequity aversion, reduce the social comparison by, you know, particularly social comparison by putting people into teams. You take away the competition. So it's like, for example, the best way sometimes to somebody you might not like very much, yeah, if you talk to them and then you start talking to them and then they talk about somebody you don't like and they don't like, then you start getting on with that person you don't like. Yeah. You share something, you share that hatred together. Right. And, oh, okay, yeah. we get on now, you know.
Right.
And then you go your separate ways and you hate each other still. But right. but actually having, you know, this is a big issue in business and leadership and so on, about creating teams and teams of people who work together. Mm-hmm. And that's where you see that effect. But in this environment, within this movie, they're competing with each other, you know.
Right.
You can have in-group competitions, well, there's in-group, out-group competition. But it would be, if you imagine they were all to work together on one project and it was a success, that they would all get the same amount of money mm-hmm. for that and each the same gratitude for that, then you would see a reduction in this effect, you know.
So I guess it's like the inequality that really breeds this...
Or perception of it, yeah. Right. The belief right. that you're...
Have you heard that study with, I think it was chimpanzees, and I probably have most of it wrong, where they give one group of chimpanzees a better treat than the other.
The grape
versus the grape thing. Yeah.
That's the inequity aversion study I'm thinking
so
about.
So it goes deep, this.
This is shown in all the economic, there's a lot of economic literature out there, but that study by Francis De Waal is basically showing that this actually goes all the way down to
this non-human is pre-human.
Primates. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
so there's nothing we can do. We're totally screwed. It's
I'd like to think we're a little bit more better than monkeys.
I think that's the lesson of sports. The reason ideally we put our kids in sports and we play sports is not to make the NBA or NFL. It's to learn these lessons about how you're competing for a position, for quarterback or whatever, center. But if you lose out, you have to be ready to fill in for the benefit of the team. You know, these things are important lessons. It's not just to get yelled at by some neighbor's dad. You know, ideally, you should learn these things and take them with you when you're not in the NFL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I want my son to be in the NFL so bad.
Hell yeah. Get concussed.
I love that. Okay. So he says, I'm joking a few times in the movie, which I don't know if you clocked. I'm sure you did. But yeah, he's, and then it's
after
not,
he says something a little bit too far when he.
Yeah. He says, what was he? I can't remember the lines, but he's basically trying to make light out of a situation where maybe, yeah, he's like showing that he's a psychopath a little bit, and I'm joking.
Right.
And so I wanted to ask about that because, you know, I'm obsessed with comedy and comedians, and if there's a part of that, I don't know, that like, you know, gallows humor or, you know, like when we try to cover up a feeling or a neurosis or something with comedy, do you think like that's a part of these people also? Do they have that tendency to, you know, reach out in some maybe creative way?
Yeah, I mean, there's the old saying, many truth is made in jest, you know, that when you make a joke about something, then you're actually really saying what you really feel inside, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's that sort of element. There's also, you know, the if people are socially nervous, you know, you know, we've probably all done it where you're a bit socially nervous and you say a joke and nobody laughs and you get an evil look, you know. I've done that quite a few times. Just kidding. Yeah, I'm joking, you know, like, if you guys had laughed, I wouldn't have said that, you know. But that's the sort of thing where this is like, it's feeding off of their emotions in some respects, presumably.
Right.
And realizing that this strategy is not working. So he's using it a way of kind of saying, you know, avoiding what he just said, mm-hmm. you know. I don't think a lot of the time you really can, but I don't know. You know, there is some work out there actually on sense of humor in psychopaths. I can't quite remember the results, but I think that there's actually a lot of work out there on showing that when you show people jokes that are mean jokes, for example, you do get these differences that some people find it rewarding to see these mean jokes and others don't.
Right.
So. Yeah, it's it's, I think there's a growing literature in that field. So there's not really an answer to that from a scientific perspective, at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Along those lines, there was a scene towards the end where there's this model and they start talking about mergers and acquisitions, and he called it murders and executions,
right,
which was his little, one of his many jokes in there. But then later when he's leaving with this model, she says something that was really a bad judgment. She said to him, "You're sweet."
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it pointed out how people see what they want to see. And maybe that's what sociopaths and psychopaths do, is they help people see what they want to see in that person. And then the next time we saw this model, she was a head in the refrigerator.
In a bag.
She misjudged his sweetness in a massive way.
Yes.
Turns out he wasn't sweet.
No.
This is what Ted Bundy used to do. You know, he was a good-looking guy, and he would go up to attractive women, and he would say, you know, "I've got a broken arm. Can you help me?" And, you know, play the bit of the victim and be charming. And then once he got them on their own, switch. You know, the real person came out. And again, that comes to the manipulative nature of the psychopath, I think.
Right. So. And Ted Bundy had a coworker, a woman who just didn't believe it was him the whole time?
Like, he had a coworker who, she wrote a book about it, actually.
Yes.
And she, he would walk her home every night, and he would say to her, "I better walk you home because there's this, you know, killer and rapist around."
Oh my God.
And she didn't believe it for a long time. And quickly, when the evidence came out, you know, she wrote a book about it. And you know, there was a saying that, you know, Ted Bundy, and I'm not sure how true this is, but there was a saying that if you spent more than 30 minutes with him talking to him, he wouldn't kill you, you know.
Oh, interesting.
he found it easier to kill strangers, but
right,
people who he knew was more.
Because this Bateman character, he didn't kill his long-term girlfriend.
Yeah.
He didn't kill
right.
most of his coworkers. He almost killed his secretary, Jean. But then
right.
that was maybe the most intense scene in the movie, where he's got the nail gun behind her. And then they have that double entendre kind of conversation. I might hurt you if you don't leave. And she's just thinking of emotional hurt and rejection. And he's thinking, no, I'm going to chop you to bits.
Yeah.
And he didn't want it. That made it, it was the most human side of that character in that scene, because he was struggling.
And self-control there.
And she had asked him before that scene, like in the beginning of that scene, "Have you ever done, do you ever feel like doing something nice for somebody?" And in a sense, he did in that scene. His version of not killing her, overcoming his urges to kill her, was he behaved nicely by his standards.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Mm. And there was that great voicemail, which we don't have anymore, really. Everybody has cell phones. But those, you know, when you leave a voicemail greeting for somebody that it just plays, I thought that was hilarious. I don't know if you guys have house phones anymore, or if you missed that. I remembered that, like, oh, yeah, when you left a voicemail for somebody, everybody listened to it who was around.
You had to really think ahead of when you wanted to play your voicemail if you had people over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was so wild, so funny, that like it's such a personal thing. You're getting a phone call from somebody, but I guess they knew also if they were calling you that this was going to be projected through speakers. But
you,
I thought that was really
funny. Forget about those times, I think. We were part of that.
Okay, so I have so much stuff. I don't want to skip over your notes.
Well,
here,
I have a question about like some of his quotes. Bateman, he said throughout, like he said, "I'm not there." Oh, and I read a comment on YouTube where someone pointed out that when he was introducing himself in the first scene, he says, first he says, "I live in American Gardens building on West 81st Street." Then he says his name.
Right.
After he says where he lives.
Right, right, yeah.
And
he's like proud of, his.
And he says a couple of other things about how, he says, "I'm not there." He says, "I just want to fit in."
Yes.
He's giving all of these hints about his inner struggle of the, I would say my interpretation of it is a vast emptiness he's feeling from this lack of empathy.
Yes.
And how he's compensating for it.
Yeah.
But he's searching for a way to connect with it. And maybe when he kills that homeless guy, it's really fascinating because he's trying to connect with him on a human level, even though he's doing it in the most vicious, mean way. He's like, "Why don't you have a job? You smell bad."
Yeah.
And then he goes, "I have nothing in common with you." And then he kills him. But it seemed like at some level he's desperately seeking a real human connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
it seemed like he was going to help him for a second.
Right.
You know, like he was just going to give him a bunch of money, or I don't know what. Yeah, really. But kind of a weird guy, I guess.
Yeah, he was. He was weird. But it gets back to like, what is these people with this disorder? What is their inner world like? You know, I mean, it's hard for somebody who doesn't have that, I think, to even comprehend what that emptiness must feel like. You know, like to not have empathy, to not have the ability to feel regular human emotions, to not be able to care.
Yeah.
Because I bet if they were given a choice, they would select not to be a psychopath.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I'd hope. Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think, first of all, they probably, if you've never had those emotions, you don't know what you're missing, you know?
Right.
It's like a blind person doesn't know what it's like to see and they function in the world, you know, in, you know, adaptive ways. But going back to the first part, it's clearly what they're calling economics is status signaling. Is okay, you know, if I tell you where I live, that's going to automatically put you in a situation to treat me differently,
right?
And then my name comes, you know?
Right?
But if I say my name, and then that, well, maybe you're going to be focused on my name, and you're going to miss that I live on, you know,
right,
81st Street, whatever. So that's clear that and everybody does status seeking, you know, from the watch to the car you drive, you know, to the app that you wear.
Yeah, Hendrick Tom. Automotive. Yeah, I know you guys are impressed.
Yeah. So are you a pit guy or?
Yeah, I run the I'm jack like, out there in NASCAR. Yeah,
I'm like, I feel so much envy now.
Dean's a huge NASCAR guy.
Everyone from England.
But anyway, these things like state, you know, the status signaling, and I think really is captured in there because, you know, from the Patrick Bateman character, there's so much amazing psychology in that individual, you know, and somebody fitting within this sort of, you know, 80s genre as well. So I think that's really fascinating. But how do they, you know, would a psychopath want to change? Well, you know, it comes with narcissism. A narcissistic person thinks they're the best person that's ever existed, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not going to want to change, you know. Right. But, you know, again, I'm sure that there are a lot of psychopaths out there who say, you know, I wish I could, you know, particularly after they've been caught for a crime, right. Wish that they could have changed their life and they didn't have these, you know, but generally, I don't think that they worry about it too much, to tell the truth.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the narcissistic personality. I was reading just very briefly about neuroplasticity, so I was hoping you could maybe explain what that is and how it relates to abuse, because some people, I was reading a couple things about people that have like narcissistic abuse where they're in a relationship with someone who's a narcissist, or you know, they work with somebody or whatnot, and so they were pointing to neuroplasticity as a way to like heal themselves, as a way to like fix how their brain works.
Let me give you the simple example. Neuroplasticity is the development of your brain. You know, that what happens is that your brain develops at a certain rate. Mm-hmm. Its plasticity changes over time as you're developing. And as you get older, that plasticity decreases. So we can learn things very quickly when we're younger.
Right.
It gets more difficult as you get older. And that's just an example of what neuroplasticity is. There's the ability to change your brain in some respects, change the neuronal structure of your brain. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that, going back to the psychopath again, that they're not learning from a young age because they're not getting these bodily feelings of threat or guilt and so on. Mm-hmm. Then they're learning, well, this doesn't bother me and I'm getting what I want, you know, and it's rewarding if I hurt somebody. So their neuroplasticity is changing for the negative. Mm. So when you're in a relationship with somebody who's abusive and so on, clearly this is going to change your the way that you perceive those individuals, you're going to think, well, this is normal. It's okay that if I bought the wrong milk to get a punch in the face, you know, like, mm-hmm. And people, their brains are changing for them and their cognitive systems in their brain are changing for them to accept that type of behavior. And then when they obviously get out of that relationship, they're having to change it again. So, so neuroplasticity is just a way of saying, oh, you change your brain within a given environment. And how plastic your brain is.
Yeah.
You know, some people just don't have much neuroplasticity, so they're narrow-minded. You know, you know, this old joke, isn't there, that as you get older, your waist gets bigger and your mind gets smaller.
Uh-huh.
That's right. Another example of neuroplasticity, you know.
Yeah. Right. Well, you have to have a willingness to change also, yeah. Right? It has to come from you having a
intrinsic
drive.
Motivation to do it, and or some extrinsic motivation.
But some things maybe you can't learn at a certain point, whether it's a certain pronunciations of languages that have to be before age 10 or whatever arbitrary thing it is.
Yeah.
And I think you're just out of luck in those kind of situations, and maybe it has in other areas too.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I had some quotes that I wanted to, some of the best quotes that get to my favorite part of the movie, which is his inner world. Can I read a couple of these
of
things
course.
And then throw them to you guys
Please.
And see what your analysis is? Because at one point he says, I have all the characteristics of a human being, flesh, blood, skin, hair, but not a single clear identifiable emotion except for greed and disgust. Something horrible is happening inside of me, and I don't know why. My nightly bloodlust has overflowed into my days. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip. And then at the very, very end, he says, my pain is constant and sharp. I do not hope for a better world for anyone. In fact, I want my pain to be inflicted on others. I want no one to escape. So these are very interesting things that maybe show a different kind of psychopath. Because to me, that meant he is in there struggling. He's not just Bill Clinton, you know, who doesn't really seem to be struggling with
right.
with his shit.
It's funny. Just one thing is that they mentioned the word Mask of Sanity, and that's the first ever book that was written by Cleckley called The Mask of Sanity. It was about psychopaths. So it's interesting now they're actually in the movie, presuming the book as well, they're referring in some respects to that term, which is used by the clinicians, you know, for that.
But you're right. I mean, it's definitely a difference between someone who seems to enjoy it. Like there's some points in the movie we talked about earlier where it seems like he's getting a kick out of the violence or whatever.
But I think the wanting for other people to feel the pain is uniquely non-psychopathic, and I want people to feel like I feel. And there was when Mike Tyson was in his biggest struggles, and I think he's not a psychopath or a sociopath. He's turned into quite a sweetheart, as it turns out. But there was a time when he...
Make you some cookies.
But he said, I want to hurt people so they feel what I feel. Uh-huh. And that's, I think, an abused kid who had a but not a psychopath. So that's why I wonder, do psychopaths really... Was that an accurate description of a psychopath for him to be saying, I want them to feel the inner pain I feel? Mm-hmm. Does that usually the motivation of a psychopath, or is it just... Is that too deep?
Well, in my research, I found out... No, I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's difficult to get psychopaths to talk about this in the context in the context of them not being in prison, you know?
Right?
That a psychopath will make you would say that sort of thing to make people feel sorry for them, you know, because they don't really, again, they're not feeling these feelings that we feel. That sounds like if you were going through that process, you or me, we have feelings, we have emotions, then we would feel torment at that,
right?
And it would feel very aversive. But the psychopath's presumably not feeling that because he doesn't have these feelings, you know. I mean, they can feel sorry for themselves, obviously. So it is an interesting take on the psychopath in terms of this inner turmoil that he has,
right?
And is he saying that, or does, because the question is that he could be saying that to himself, and then, you know, 2 minutes later he's like whistling and, you know,
right?
Well,
it could be from a literary point of view, is that the job of the author is to make us identify with the character and care about them. So it could be just taking artistic license with the actual symptoms of one of these guys so the reader can identify with this person's otherwise unidentifiable.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I really got the vibe. I mean, this time specifically when I was watching the movie and trying to analyze stuff, that it really wants us to analyze ourselves and the people around us and why we do the things we do, why we feel the things that we feel, and how we can. That's why I was trying to get into this whole neuroplasticity stuff and trying to change my own brain, because I Not that I really connected with this character, but there were certain times where I felt like I had all these questions, you know, like, am I happy when people fail? Do I, like, how competitive am I? You know, this character trait reminds me of this friend who, why is he like that? And, you know, so I really enjoyed that they, and maybe that is why he had these quotes towards the beginning and towards the end, where it makes you think that.
I think that's a really interesting take on it because, you know, we all have a bit of psychopath in us, you know. We can see things. We can walk down the street and see a down and out and just ignore them and walk by them or, you know.
Right.
And in some respects, that individual is in the worst place that we'd ever want to be ourselves. But we can just walk by them without any feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have this ability to switch our emotions off, mm-hmm. you know. It's just that gradient of that, the space in which they're working with the psychopath is like this, ours is like that, you know,
yeah.
small. So versus large, they extend it to everything and we extend to the things that are select. And we can't feel those emotions all the time. Every time that you get a gig and one of your friends didn't get the gig or somebody you know, you can't go up to them like crying, saying, I'm so sorry that you didn't get it.
right.
And not feel happy yourself. There has to be an element in there, I think, to downplay these emotions ourselves.
I think it's probably just an important and maybe overarching like message of the movie and of the book is to keep track, is to clock it, not just live and be unaware of all these things or be ignorant on purpose, but to actually look in the mirror, to analyze your life every day and think, okay, wait a minute, what's appropriate? What should I be caring about, you know?
Yeah.
Because like you just said, I mean, you know, I've in LA, there's a homeless population, you know, it's out of control. And I think about it all the time, you know, sometimes it just hits me randomly in the car, just in a wave of like, holy shit, what can I do? How can I get out there? And then, like you're saying, if somebody, I'm not going to feel bad if, you know, I'm in a fortunate situation, somebody's not sometimes. So I think it's really good in art to come away from something like this and actually be putting it into a lot of different aspects of my life. You know, how does this affect me? What can I do to change? How can I be a better person?
Mm. Yeah.
That to me is like, oh, this is a great film. You know, it really stays with you that way.
It's very deep.
Yeah, don't become a Wall Street guy for starters.
Yeah, don't steal a bunch of money from idiots.
Well, this makes this discussion here just makes me think of the indoctrination that the military does when they take in a 19-year-old or whatever and they have to teach them to be a non-empathetic murderer and then switch gears back when they get home.
Oh, man, it's like an impossible transition.
They figured it out. They figured out how to turn someone into a willing killer, but then it's quite obvious that they're from the PTSD explosion that it's not easy to shift gears back.
No, not at all. It's much easier on the smaller scale of stuff that we deal with than to take it to the extreme like that. I also just briefly wanted to mention hedonism and that I think it was at its peak apparently in the 80s with these guys.
Oh, the Jamaica vacation spot?
No, what is that?
Oh, there's this all-inclusive Jamaican resort called Hedonism.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if it's still out there.
I gotta look that up.
That's references that for a
cocktail,
few.
Cocktail, Tom Cruise,
Right.
I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's also like an ancient
philosophy of
life, philosophy of life.
Yeah, just enjoying everything and not taking things seriously and being drunk and just enjoy your life, which got a lot of people in trouble around this time.
Gout and liver disease.
And being behind bars coke.
Is it specifically about pursuing pleasure or something? I think pleasure plays a big role in hedonism. I could be wrong.
From what I understand, you know, I can't remember if it was like ancient Greece or
there's a philosophy of it.
And now I think more than ever it's looked down upon and it's more, you know, we have to look out for each other and you have to be always trying, you know, a nonprofit organization. If you're rich, people are always looking, okay, how are you helping out? Not just enjoying your wealth and enjoying your time on earth.
Right.
And so curiously, philosophically, how do you guys balance that out? You know, because you want to enjoy your life. You want to have a good quality of life.
But I think that we come locked and loaded out of the package with a certain tendency towards wanting to have social responsibility and to care about our group, and tell me if I'm wrong. But it just takes a little bit of positive reinforcement to keep that going. And I'll tell you, when I was walking with this guy, Rob Cohen from Canada, a comedy guy, and there was a piece of trash on the ground, And he bent over and picked it up and put it in the trash. And I thought, well, it's so Canadian of him. You know, they have a better sense of, we're all responsible for our place here.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe we've gotten away from that a little bit in schools. I don't know. I haven't been to elementary school in a while. But I think that there used to be, and in some places there still is, a sense of you have a certain amount of responsibility to do the best for the people around you. And, mm-hmm. and even corporations used to have to prove that they had some social value besides looting.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, well, what do you think?
I agree. You know, you often think when you see people like, you know, if I was a billionaire, I'd probably just, you know, buy an house on a beach and just sit there. But, you know, you soon get bored, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I think that a lot of the time the people who do have the money and the billionaires, well, they've got to that position because of their work ethic, and then and they enjoy that.
Right.
So I think that... That it's a philosophy, I think, that is makes sense. But I think that, you know, like in America, which is not a socialist culture as we know, there's a it seems to me that more of the Republican philosophy is that the government shouldn't take my money to help the people. I should have the choice to spend to give my money to charities and whatever. And the socialist philosophy that is, you know, we have in Britain and well, in Europe, it's all about kind of spreading the wealth and but also enjoying yourself. You know, we get in the UK, we get a lot more time off. It's like 7 weeks a year. Mm. So it's about like, you know, spreading the wealth then and enjoying yourself as well. And I think as you go to places like Denmark or Norway, it's even more so Sweden than it is in Great Britain. So there's definitely a problem with that within the US, where there's minimal amount of time that people have off. And if you want to be in a job that's one that's fun, then you're not going to get paid, you know? So,
right.
I just come from a different sort of background in some respects, that that's just really a part of where we come, where of Europe and maybe Canada as well.
Yeah.
Although we've seen the British Brexit, which is, you know, shoots that theory completely in the foot. But so definitely there has to be some form of social responsibility. But, you know, everyone has the right to have a life which is enjoyable and fun,
yeah,
and do everything that they seem as a
right. We have socialism for banks and large corporations only. It's everyone else is on their own,
yeah,
no safety net. But if something goes wrong with a giant financial institution,
I'll bail them out.
They get all the money in the world.
They're
these are too big to fail. Things would be really bad. Yeah. But in fact, if those places were allowed to fail, there would have been much healthier things filling in there. So what we have, socialism by sociopaths for psychopaths.
Welcome to America, baby. Yeah, I was just going to chime in and say that I try to practice like a self-control with pleasure stuff, like purposefully limiting things that I make me really, really happy, because I think it's
You're talking about porn.
And I'll see you next time, guys. But that's actually not a bad example, because, like, you know, okay, you watch porn now and then, fine, everybody does it, it's all cool. Too much of that, too much of a good thing is like always a bad thing. Too much chocolate, too much brownies, your body's gonna deteriorate, right? You know, too much TV, you don't have, like, who are you as a person now? You don't experience life. So I try to, because I think everything now is just so on demand. Everything is so available all the time now. You know, you can go to the store and buy a bunch of brownies for $2, you know?
What are we doing here?
Let's go! So I really, it's like a huge thing for me. I try to like purposefully like, nope, I'm not going to do this thing. I'm going to do the more like boring, mundane shit, so that when I have a little piece of that, you know, pie, which I haven't had in a month or two, it's delicious, you know, and it makes me so happy. And I just feel like that was the problem, I guess, in the 80s, or for people that are really rich and just don't practice that, because it's just all the time.
It's habituation to it. It's, you know, it's certainly if you're going out to restaurants like the, you know, top restaurants all the time, then
What does it matter anymore?
What does it matter? But for most of us, it's just like, this is a special occasion. Or
yes.
So, you know.
Right. And I want that. I want to keep it special, I guess. And I'm worried about, you know, losing that. And
that's
so,
why I would never want to be a billionaire, because I could. wait, don't just say that.
I was going to give you $1 billion.
There is an old expression. I'm sure it's 1,000 years old, but too much is the same as not enough. In other words, there's a poverty of excess that'll fuck you up just as much as being broke.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And, so it's important.
But to your thing, I think that having children solves what you're talking about by. If you just put yourself on the kind of schedule and limitations that you do for children, it sounds like, oh, I have no choice. It's 8:30. Got to go to bed. Oh, got to get up. This is when we eat. This is when we stop eating.
Yeah,
it's where we get into trouble is this, like, the emptiness of grabbing with no schedule or limitations.
Right.
And I think that's why a lot of people, maybe even me, when we got out of college, were lost for a while. Like, what now? Mm-hmm. This we had 10-week quarters in the UC system, and these 10-week quarters would, like, rip by. And you're just used to one quarter, 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 quarter. And then you graduate, and you're like, in 10 weeks, it's going to be the same as now. There's no midterm. There's no final. There's nothing. This is it.
Yeah.
And so schedules, man, schedules make life just schedule. That works for me anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you've preached it to me before and it has helped out a lot. I'm a list guy. I like to make
a lot
of.
And you can calculate that, you know, if you like to axe murder people, just do it from 8.
Yep.
To 9.
I said, a little bit is okay.
I only chop heads 8 to 9.
Yeah.
And then you're going to get more done.
Yeah. Come on, guys. Be reasonable. Don't let it get out of control. Okay. We're wrapping up, guys. Is there something, any other points you want to mention about the movie? What about stuff to promote? Should people take your class? You have a Twitter, something? D-mobs?
Can we get into Caltech? What do we have to do first?
Yeah. How can we get in there, man?
Well,
I want to teach.
Suitcase of cash, untraceable.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah,
easy. No
and
problem.
I might be able to help you out there.
All right.
But just my website, my lab website, which is www.deanmobslab.com. Okay. And if you're interested in reading any research on fear or anxiety, then feel free to go to my website.
Okay, fantastic. Thomas.
Well, if you want to watch Clash-O-Rama, the Clash of Clan based cartoon.
Yep.
It's on YouTube, and I think you'll enjoy it even more than the game.
Yeah, it is very funny. Yeah. I have seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it?
That's it.
Do
you have a card?
I do. I'm going to give them to you. It's bone.
You have a card.
The color bone I learned is a color.
It's a finger
bone.
With a tattoo on it.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom.
Thank you,
Dean.
It's
been delightful. And I hope we all cross paths again. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Good show. I could talk forever. I'm a blabbermouth.
Before we turn off the lights here, I wanted to say a couple things. First of all, Willem Dafoe is in this movie, and I just want to go on record saying he rocks. Also, I mentioned lithium earlier in the podcast. Nobody knew exactly what it was for, so I looked it up. Lithium is used to treat the manic episodes of bipolar disorder. It can help stabilize wild mood swings caused by the illness and can reduce the risk of suicide. It works by affecting the flow of sodium through the nerve and muscle cells in the body. It's pretty interesting stuff, but I've never taken it and I'm not speaking from experience. Also, since we're on the topic, if anything in the podcast made you think that you might be a sociopath or a narcissist, or if you think maybe I should do therapy and give it a shot, I would highly recommend it. There's no shame in trying to seek help, and talking to a professional will probably affect you in a positive way. So anyway, where was I? This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our social media producers are EJ Gullett and Kate Baker, and the executive psycho-ducer, who's not psycho at all, he's a great dude, is Brett Kushner. Follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show, and feel free to write us an iTunes review. That helps other people find out about us, which I really appreciate. For anything else, questions, comments, concerns, suggestions, email us badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com, and I will see you next week when we will be discussing Ice Age. See you later.